Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Your body is unique. So why would you settle for a weight loss plan that's one size fits all? Noom is the weight management program that takes into account your biology to build a custom plan just for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a guest comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Sam Jay. Sam has been a writer at Saturday Night Live since 2017, where she's written Them Trumps, the most recent Black Jeopardies, and released early from the At Home editions. Sam is also just one of the best stand-ups. Period. Comedians have known this for a while now, and soon to join them is the rest of the country, with Sam releasing her first hour special, 3 in the Morning, on Netflix last week. What makes Sam so good is on full display in the joke you're about to hear from the special. She does what the greats can, which is just pack so much into one joke. A simple premise of being afraid to fly goes in so many directions while also displaying different paces and joke types. And it's worth noting that the joke we're going to play is actually part of a larger story of going to London with her girlfriend that runs through the entire special. It is one of the most exciting stand-up debuts in recent memory. One note, there were some issues with Sam's audio. We did our best. Thank you to my producers. So, here is Sam Jay.
I'm a very nerve-wracked flyer. I hate fucking flying. I'm thinking about dying the whole time. The entire trip, I'm just like, I'm fucking dead up here, you know? I think if you're not thinking about dying, you're a psychopath. I don't know anyone who's just up there like, this is how God intended it. You know, what the fuck? It's like, clearly we have no business up there. We're watching ESPN, we're drinking. Who the fuck do we think we are? So ballsy, chill out, you know? This is delicate. Then we like to give the illusion of safety in case of an emergency. Bitch, we're dead if there's an emergency. This motherfucker's in the exit row with his shoes off, drunk. He's saving all of us. He's the guy. He's the point man. Fuck you. Fuck you. You don't give a shit about us. I watched you give this man drinks. Maybe don't serve drinks to the exit row niggas or all the niggas. Maybe they have to be sober. You want me to feel safe in the skies? Kiss my ass. And I think about death in a weird, like, I don't think like how most, I think most people think some regular ass shit, right? They think like, I don't know, what if the pilot takes us into a mountain today because he hates his fucking life? Or what if the engine fails? That's normal thoughts. I think crazy, crazy shit. I think like, what if the company that makes the chemical, that makes the doodle block, okay, so when you're on a plane and you shit or you piss, it don't just go to the birds, baby. Right? You don't just flush it, it's in the sky. No, it stays on the fucking plane like a camper, and there's a chemical in there and it makes a gelatinous mess. And when you land, they suck that shit out. They put a new chemical in for your next flight. I'd be thinking, what if the doodle block company, right? The chemical company, what if they skimp on a chemical? Just on some American greed shit. American companies are trash. They're always doing this type of fuck shit, cutting corners. We know this, cutting corners, doing funny shit. What if one of these fucking companies is like, hey, you know what? We're not buying boric acid this month. We don't fucking need boric acid. It's $30,000 a unit, and it really doesn't do anything. Then I'm in the sky. I take a shit. The plane's half a pound heavier. Boom, into a mountain. Fucking dead. That's what the hell goes on in my brain. Shit that can't be cured with no safety video, you know? Fuck are you? So I'm nervous. I'm on edge. As soon as I get on the plane, I'm on edge. I'm on it. I'm making sure everyone's phone's in airplane mode because that's everybody's job. I'm just like, look at him. Why this nigga on Candy Crush like that? Who's gonna do something about that? That's weird. I don't like any of this. Then I sit down and I notice my girl's still fucking around on her phone. She ain't fucking changed her shit yet. She playing games and shit. So I'm like, hey, baby, when you gonna do it? The guy said, do it. I think you should go ahead and do it. And she snaps at me because she's still mad over the bag shit. So she's like, you don't gotta do it till the plane takes off. And it's like, bitch, you don't build planes. You don't. You're not a plane scientist or no shit like that. You do it when the nigga driving the plane says it's time to do it. That's opportune time. And that caused a whole nother fight because I hit the button on that bitch. I was like, Bing, get her the fuck out of here. Mm-mm-mm-mm. I'm not going to the sky with this bitch. She acting up on the ground. How the fuck we gonna go in the sky? You not following the ground rules, baby girl. That don't add up. So then I'm in my seat and shit, right? And now we fighting. We trying to whisper fight like white people. You know, trying to get a good whisper fight in. We, you know, that goofy, goofy stuff. And her main thing is like, she likes to fuck with me. Like, she likes to like say shit to me. Like, she's reminding me I'm a woman. Like, I fucking know that, you know? But she likes to, because of my outfits and shit. You know what I mean? Because of how I dress, she's like, you know, I'm a break you down, remind you a whole bitch. It's like, bitch, I got a pad in these boxer briefs. I know what's happening. I don't need this energy from you. Goofy ass. So we're sitting in the seat and we're arguing. And then she's like, well, what the fuck are you so afraid of, you scary bitch? Are you on your period? And I was like, what? I got so fucking mad. Balled up my fist real tight like I was about to punch the seat in front of me or something, like I was just gonna act, you know? But I remember the last time I did that, we were at the house, I balled my fist up and I punched the wall and then I just hurt my hand real bad. Nothing happened, so I was like, let me chill. So I was just like, what to do? And then I just told the truth. I was like, I'm afraid to die. I yelled that on a plane. Just put it out there, you know? Just fucking be honest. But as soon as I said it, I realized it's not true. I think I needed to hear it out loud. I was like, that's not it. I'm not afraid to die, actually. Death is inevitable. I know it's gonna happen. I'm not afraid to die. I realized in that moment, what I'm afraid of is surviving. I don't wanna survive a plane crash. I think about being that one asshole floating on a piece of wing in the middle of the ocean. Way more than I think about death. Just on some Life of Pi shit, just live, nigga. No, that's trash. No, I don't want to survive shit.
So I'm here with Sam J, the woman behind the joke you just heard. Thank you so much for being here.
What's up?
So before we get into the joke, I just wanted to provide a little context of your journey for the listener. You know, as you've told it, after growing up loving comedy, the first time you tried stand-up was around 21, but you stopped because it didn't feel right. It wasn't until 29 that you tried again and have been going for like 9 years or so since.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about sort of that 8-year period and deciding to do comedy again? And also, what by 29... did you realize were the types of jokes that felt right?
Well, in that 8-year span in between, right, when I first started and when I picked up the mic again, I was just like, just kind of in the world fucking up, mm-hmm. and running around. You know what I mean? I didn't really have any direction. I had no idea really what I wanted to do. And I was just doing a lot of like menial bullshit jobs and, you know, just feeling really like I'm just passing through, but I'm not mm-hmm. existing. You know, I'm not present and I'm not like contributing. I don't know a better word for it, you know? Yeah. And I just felt like the path that my life was going in, that I was selling myself short, to be mm-hmm. honest, and that I was settling. And it was like, you know, there's something bigger for you than this. Like, you feel it every day when you walk into this mail room in this basement, you know? So that started to be like weigh on me, you know what I mean? Yeah. But I still didn't know like what to do. Yeah. I didn't know what to do. But I was always like into comedy, you know, hence why I tried it in the first place and always watched it, always knew who the new comics were, like just was always on top of that kind of stuff because I was just really into it. And I loved making people laugh in my way, you know, which was, I'm not a roaster, you know what I mean? And I have a lot of funny friends, but they like to roast and shit like that. I'm way more observational and like witty, and it takes me a while to like build a joke, you know, to really get something to where I'm like, yeah, this is confidently funny to me. But I do enjoy making people laugh, you know, and pushing buttons a little bit. I have fun doing both of those things. And I used to see a lot of shit and just be like, I want to make a difference, but like, how do I make that difference as me, I guess, mm-hmm. is without the best way I could explain it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just always felt like when I was being funny, but also like, you know, talking about something that might be more heavy, I like people listened. You know what I mean? It was just like, yeah. Oh, this is a space where I'm able to command attention, for lack of a better word. And it seemed a space where I could be effective.
Yeah.
And that's all I ever really wanted to feel, was just like, I'm here and I'm not just passing through. Like, I'm affecting this experience in some way and being a part of this experience for real. And it just, everything was pushing me towards comedy.
Hmm. You know, comedians like to say, oh, it takes 10 years. It takes 10 years before you're really good, whatever that means. But, you know, you've pushed back on that idea, as partly as a lot of that 10 years is because people are starting so young that, like, you just have mm-hmm. to not be an immature idiot for part of those times. And you start at 29, and there's, I imagine, some advantages of sort of starting more mature, but sort of looking back at it now, how do you think you benefited from that arc to sort of start at 29, where you sort of had this life? Maybe you've avoided bad habits young comedians would have had, bad tendencies.
I mean, I think it was just an overall, starting at 29 gave me an overall ability to commit to something and to like work at it. And like, I had a vision for it because I wasn't a kid. So I wasn't like doing comedy to fit in. I wasn't doing comedy to make friends. I wasn't doing comedy to like, I was just like, all right, I think that I can be effective this way. And so I feel like I was a lot more focused in that way as to what I was trying to accomplish. I was clear on what I wanted to do. And I think that helped me move through it, you know? Yeah. And as far as on stage, the confidence of age was just like, I'm not talking and I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so before we get into the sort of specific joke, let's sort of just sort of talk about your general process. What does sort of writing a joke mean for you?
I mean, I feel like I'm just always, you know, picking up things from, you know, the day, you know, life, like as life happens, I'm noticing the funny things or the things that I find funny or weird or awkward or, you know, just interesting, like entry points into conversations, you know, and dialogues that I'm interested in having on stage. And then from there, I'll just like jot little ideas down about it, things that are sticking out in my head about it. And then most of the work for me happens on stage. Then I just start bringing it on stage and like kind of talking through it until I find it.
Mm-hmm. And are you tape recording sets and are you using that? Is that how you sort of build from there?
I used to do it mad heavy, especially when I first started. I used to do it heavy and listen all the time. And like, I don't do it as much as I used to. I feel like I learned the mechanisms for my brain now. Like, it's like the routine of it has now become a part of just my thinking process. I don't need to do that recording stuff as much because I remember a lot of like, you want to change that. You need to do that. Mm. But there's definitely some sense during the process of the special because it was such a big deal to me. And it was my first hour and I didn't want to like miss anything. That there was definitely some sense that I did like record and listen to. Or if I said something very specific that night that I was like, yo, that was interesting, I like listen back to that part. But I can't really sit and just like listen to myself anymore. It's like cringy to me.
Yeah.
So it's like I got to pick and choose the battle on that one.
Yeah. So this joke about sort of broadly, it's about being afraid to fly. It's made up, I would say, sort of in like five sections. There's the idea that you should be afraid to fly. Then there's sort of thinking about dying in a weird way section. Then there's sort of putting your phones in airplane mode section. Then there's the whispered fight. And then they're sort of actually you're afraid to survive, not afraid to die. But what was sort of the initial spark for this? Where did it start?
If you really want to get into it, there's an iteration of that joke in the bit that I do about white men and flying. Mm. And like who only white guys would look in the sky, see a bird and be like, yeah, I should be able to do that. And just like the gall of it all, you know. Mm-hmm. So a part of that lives in that joke of just the audacity of humans to even be up here, you know. So if I had to look at like where it first started, my brain started thinking in that direction, it was around that joke, which I probably told like 3 years before that, 4 years before my special, you know. So, but then it was like I was doing so much fucking flying. I think that's why a lot of times you hear some type of airplane joke in every comics, like every first timer special.
Yep.
I feel like there's some type of something about the fucking plane. You know what I mean? And I didn't even mean for that to happen. And now that it's in there, I'm a little bit of me wishes it wasn't. Because I'm like, hey, everybody does that. But it was so honest. And it truly just was what was going on with me because I was doing so much flying to go to do all these shows to get ready to take this hour. And I was always with my girl. Like, we did the whole European tour together. Like, she went with me the whole way. So, you know, we were having all those type of conversations, you know, and arguments. So, like, the button and the sleep airplane mode, that's like a real, it was like a fight. It was a genuine whole fight. Because I am super scary and she doesn't care. She does not care about flying. She could care the fuck less. But my girl is also very much one of those people who's like, God got me, you know, and she'll just move. And I'm just not like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like that was where the first part of it came from, was that whole starting to just think about the audacity of flight, you know? And then the middle was just really a culmination of what was going on in our relationship. And the last part really about like death and kind of like the weird ways to die was really just me being on a plane and just constantly being in the air and thinking about like, what are you actually afraid of?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're clearly petrified. Are you afraid of crashing? It's like, yeah, but am I? And then I was like, it's like, I do think the craziest shit. Like, I really was thinking that on a plane. I really was sitting on a plane and someone went to shit and I was starting to think about like, what if the chemicals is wrong and what if this and that? And I'm like, that's the problem, is my brain just like, it goes nutty. It doesn't even just live in like, we could crash. It goes like insane. Yeah. But I also thought it was funny as fuck that I was thinking like that. I was like, this is such a wild way to process this all.
It's interesting. You're able to both experience the sort of anxiety of it and know it's funny, but it doesn't make it so you're not still anxious about it. So it still is real, but you're able to sort of be both yourself and the you later who's going to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, because it's like, for sure I was petrified, but it was also like, well, if this plane lands, this would be a fun thing to discuss.
Exactly.
If we do make it, this would be an interesting thing to talk about, you know? And I guess I just try to think about things that, like, I try to hit the real core of shit. I feel like you could always, like, just hit this surface of, like, oh, I'm scared to die. Or, oh, but it's like, nah, like, what is your brain really doing? That's always kind of been interesting to me.
Yeah. So you've talked about how when you develop material, you like to sort of go in different directions and see how the audience responds. Maybe you'll try something that's a little bit more harsh or maybe offensive. Oh, you know, just like really try to push it to see where the boundaries of this joke are, where the audience is at. Can you talk about what that's like in practice? Were there directions this joke ultimately didn't stay in that were like maybe too much for an audience?
I think that like in that particular process of that joke, it was just like kind of more so filtering out like what are the like the hits, because it was like a long story, you know what I mean? And I was like, all of this isn't funny, you know, some of it is just what happened, or maybe some of it's just shit I think is funny, but like it's really not like translating. I don't really have a specific that jumps out to me. I just know that as I was like doing the joke, it was a constant editing process. And then there were some things that got injected, you know, at first I feel like all I had was just like the top of it, of like the ballsiness of being in the sky. And then I had the like castaway part of it. I didn't have any of that stuff with like the plane and my girl and the, but that all came from that actually happening once we went to Europe. So like that piece came kind of later and kind of created the kind of bridge in the middle of all of that shit for me. And that's kind of how I do jokes. I just always like, I just like keep fucking with them.
Yeah. That's interesting that you had this sort of like initial thing that you found absurd that sort of launches you into it. And then you sort of had, I guess, the realization, and then you're like, how can I get to this realization in a way that sort of feels organic without me just sort of saying it?
Exactly. How can I like build it in the bit, like in the set where it feels like organic? Exactly. Because I want people to be able to like take a journey with me, you know? I want it to feel like, okay, we're just like walking through this person's mind. And like, I want them to be able to see the steps, you know? Like, this is how you leap from here. Because I take wild leaps, right? Yeah. But I mentally do that. So for me, like the trickery was like, how do I take them through the leaps? Like, how do I show them how my brain can go from this to the toilet chemical being wrong to castaway? Which is exactly what my brain does. You know what I'm saying? But like, how do I map that?
Yeah, it's really interesting because it, at first, this joke is a very internal story. It's like a lot of thoughts you had, and that is, it's, you know, it's like a, it's, which is good, but there's a bit of like a show don't tell where you like want to show, oh, I'm like, this is a thing that I think, and this is how it interacts with the world thinking this way. Like, instead of like, I'm not just telling you, like, this has real consequences. I'm getting into these fights for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to, because I know there's so much to this joke, I want to sort of dive deeper into each section. And just sort of talk more about your thought process. So the first section, which is, you know, talking about the sort of the gall of being confident that you should fly, and you talked about how that evolved. What is really interesting is, you know, you've talked about being vulnerable in your stand-up's important, and if something scares you, that means it's something you should be talking about. And as we said, this is like the idea that flying is like an obvious territory for a lot of comedians, but even saying like, oh, I'm afraid to fly is a thing people say. But what you do is you sort of straight out in third sentence, like, I'm thinking about dying this whole time. Like, you're telling the audience really early into this joke, really early into the special, like, death is in this joke. Is that scary for you to talk about? You know, in general, why is it important for you to sort of talk about that sort of darker parts of you?
Because it's what I really feel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, to me, that's the joke. To me, it's just like, I'm really up here just the whole flight. Just like, and like my girl could be a testament to it. Like, I'm always like looking out the window, any one little bump, I'm listening to the engine. I'm like, this engine don't sound like the engine on the last plane. I feel like this engine sounds different. So like, it's really what's happening in my head. You know what I mean? And so like, I don't know. I just get on stage and try to tell the truth and be funny at the same time, of course. But a lot of it is just me like being like, I know I'm not the only motherfucker thinking this shit.
Was the exit row drunk stuff based on a specific experience?
Yeah, we was on a plane. I can't remember where we were going. We were going to London or Australia, and this African guy got me, took his shoes off. And then he like, there was like a little hump on the door, like the exit door, like the emergency door.
Yeah.
And he just sat on it. And I was like, that's fucking wild. Like, why are they letting this happen? And the students just kept walking by. So I was on high alert because of that dude. And then I looked, and the other dude, he was in the exit row with his feet stretched with two drinks. And I was just like, this is fucking crazy. Like, why are they letting the important people behave this way. Like, I just, it was blowing me because I was so scared up there. And I was like, this ain't safe.
Yeah. A lot of it's in the inflection where you go, I watched you give this man drinks. Like, you sort of, are you deliberate about phrasing in that way? Are you like, how do I sort of, are you playing with like, how can I say the sentence in a way?
Yeah, for sure. I think at first I was just like, they're giving them drinks. You know what I mean? And that feels different than I watch you. I mean, words are important. You know what I mean? Especially for a stand-up.
Yeah.
So like, for sure, I said it one way. But I don't necessarily like remember. I don't go, oh, you said it like this. Try it like this. It just eventually will start coming out different ways when I keep telling a story. And then the way that like bangs and I like, that's the way I keep.
Yeah. In this section, you say, you know, a few times. I'm not sure exactly how intentional it is, but it's a thing.
Completely unintentional. I saw it and it drove me fucking crazy.
But I will say, I have brought this up to comedians before because there are a few comedians that do it and they also say it's unintentional and it's a tick and they don't like it. But it is specifically a thing comedians do who are more conversational. It is a conversational comedian's thing to do, which is like checking in, constantly trying to like as if you're talking, like, you know, is a thing you'd say to a person in a conversation. Yeah. Like, yeah, you're with me, you know. Why is it important that your material, regardless of your desire not to have those you knows, why is it important that your material is conversational?
This is the thing. It's such a weird thing because it was a decision that I made when early. So if you said I could be a nerd, so I'll be a nerd.
Yeah,
before I even really started getting on stage, I would go to bars and like, basically I was like workshopping shit before I was ready to like get up with the shit. I would go to bars by myself and just like sit with people and spark conversations and talk about shit that I would force the conversation in the direction I wanted it to
go.
To basically try jokes, you know what I'm saying? To be quite honest. And I would do this shit like as a practice, and that helped me get the confidence to get up on stage.
Yeah.
So I was like kind of using that as a like a playground, practice ground type shit. So I would do that stuff, and then like eventually I built that up into some like, you just need to go get on stage and stop being a pussy and like trying jokes out on unsuspecting people. And like, I'm killing at bars, you know? They're like, yeah, that's so great. But I'm like, this is like the pussy ass way to go about this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So when I decided like I'm gonna do these mics and I'm gonna get on stage, I just told myself it has to feel like that. Yeah. It has to feel how it felt in the bars.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't feel like that, then I'm doing something wrong because that's when I'm at my best. I was like, that's just when you in the zone. So tailor the experience on stage and just try to make it feel like that. Mm-hmm. And just get as close to that as you can get and you'll be doing something right.
I mean, it's really interesting because that is a realization that I hear comedians realize so much later in the process. Like, I've known so many comedians where literally they get advice 7 years in and they're like, you're really funny off stage. Why are you funnier off stage than you are on stage? Like, why are you not the guy you are in the green room? And that's like a light bulb. And you realize that before you started.
Well, because I was like, any other way, it ain't gonna click.
Yeah.
It clicks this way. Because then once I'm feeling that confidence, then that's when my brain can run. But if I'm like being this like awkward version of myself, then I'm doing too much thinking and not enough doing.
Yeah.
and then we're going to get in trouble. But I think that came with age.
Yeah.
I had other experiences in my life where I was trying to be something and do. So also like comedy for me was also like a present to me. It was like, you're going to go try this thing for you. So this has nothing to do with nobody but you. You're doing this for you to see if you can do it. And can you do it the way you think you can? And so I wasn't willing to make a lot of concessions in that way.
Yeah. So the joke moves and you have the weird ways in which you think about death section on the plane. Did you have other examples of that other than the doodoo block example?
Nope.
Did you have the word doodoo block right away? Is that like...
I don't know if I was always saying doodoo block. I don't know. I want to say very early on, I was like, it's the gelatinous mess and they suck it out. Yeah, I think I still say doodoo block. I think I still say doodoo block from the jump.
you immediately know what you're talking about, even mm-hmm. though it's never words that I've seen put together.
But it makes sense. Like, yeah. You know.
This part of the joke does something that I think you're really good at, which is sort of, you start the joke and you think it's about one thing or it's about a personal experience. And then it's sort of like, oh, now it's about corporate greed for a bit. Like, it's about a completely different thing. I mean, maybe it's just where your mind goes, but, you know, why is it important to sort of like make sure that stays in? Like, why do you want to be like, yeah, I'm telling a personal story and it's rooted in me, but like also want to like have commentary in it. I want to make sure I'm saying something.
I just feel like this is how I think, you know what I'm saying? So like, when I was telling that joke, it was just kind of like a natural progression. I didn't really even feel like I need to make a statement on corporate greed. I was just like, we hear all these stories all the time about this, like people just being trash. And I was on the plane like, so who's to say someone's not being trash now? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we know this type of behavior exists. And like, we're always hearing these like, oh, they sold faulty parts and they knew it. They, you know what I mean? So I was just kind of like, that's just where it went. And I watch a lot of American Greed and shit. So that it should be just in my head.
Yeah. The other thing about this part is it sort of switches the pace up. You know, like the earlier sections and even later sections are sort of more laughs per minute. But this one is sort of a long build to when you say like boom into the mountain. You know, one, what's the value to that? What do you like about not necessarily trying to like joke? And also sort of how you're approaching it to make sure the audience is still with you on a sort of a longer part.
Honestly, when I first started really like doing stand-up very early on, I was kind of like, I had this goal of an hour in my head. Like I knew that's what I was building towards. You know what I'm saying? Because I was like, that's the thing, you know, that's what you're trying to get to. You want to be able to do an hour your way in front of your audience, because that's when you'll know. And this wasn't necessarily like I need an hour special. I just wanted to have an hour of material.
Yeah. You know, for what I'm touring saying? Or for whatever.
Yeah. And I was just like, that's how you're going to know if you're nice enough. Mm-hmm. When you holding it down for like an hour, and it's like, that's when you really gonna see your potential. You know what I mean? And what you really could do with this thing, how far can you take it? You know, you can't really tell your level of sauce in 10 minutes, 15 minutes, especially when that shit gets old. It starts to get old quick. Where you're like, damn, I need more time. I had more to say about that, you know? So the hour was like the goal. And in trying to like build an hour, I would watch other people's hours, you know? Chris Rock, Hannibal, Dave Chappelle, whoever, George Carlin, whoever. And one thing I started to notice was just like, people ain't laughing the whole time like that, bro.
Yeah.
Like even in a cat women's person, not to say people don't laugh, but there's just times where people are listening because you're crafting something for them. And that's okay. And when I was, you know, younger in comedy, I was so uncomfortable in that space. And I just would be running to the laughs, you know? I would just be like, I didn't like any real space. So I would be rushing to punchlines and rushing to shit. And sometimes big pieces or good tags would get missed because I was just like, they ain't laughing, got to get them to the laughing. They ain't laughing, got to get them to the laughing, which I'm sure a lot of young comics do, you know? And then when I started doing Slades in Boston, which is the Black Room, and Jonathan Gates started telling me like, yo, you ready to headline? I'm going to take you out. One of the things he was always telling me is like, slow down. Why are you rushing? And I was just like, I don't. And he's like, yo, just slow down. Like, they following you. They listening. That's okay. And coupled with watching people's hours, I just started training myself. Like, yo, you got to get comfortable in that silence. And especially the type of comedy you like to do, it's going to get awkward up there.
Yeah.
And you just got to be cool with that and stop being so pressed and so thirsty, really, and chill the fuck up and trust your jokes. Be confident that you're going to bring them to the other side of this. And they're going to be okay. And they're going to get paid off. You're not going to leave them hanging. So just trust yourself, trust your jokes, and just get more comfortable up there. Because I feel like if I wanted to do a good hour, it was going to have some of that.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's as you're talking about the type of comedy you like to do, it's like, if you give them payoff too quickly, then they will have not felt it. Like, if you want them to feel tense, you need to let there be tension. We'll be right back with more Sam J.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright. exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W, and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Most weight loss programs focus on restriction and inflexible routine, which is why most diets fail. But Noom isn't a diet. It's a weight management program that uses psychology and biology to help you develop healthy, sustainable habits. Noom believes that weight loss starts with the brain, and their daily lessons are tailored to help users understand the science behind food cravings and eating choices. Whether you want to lose weight, increase physical activity, meet a health goal, or simply change the way you think about food, Noom can help you build healthy habits while still enjoying your favorite foods. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first-ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
And we're back with Sam J. So then it goes into sort of the putting the phone away stuff. So you had, you know, there's both your girl not having her phone out and there's a guy playing Candy Crush. Is that actually like a sort of a amalgam of like a variety of different experiences?
It's like two. Yeah, it's a few. It's different ones. It's like me and my girl definitely had to fight about the, and I did hit the button and the lady did come. And my girl was very pissed. She called me a bitch ass nigga, to be exact, for most of the rest of the flight because she was hot that I told on her. So that was one experience. And then I just always see people playing on their fucking phone still, and it drives me crazy.
This part of the joke sort of has what I think is the climax, which is she says, you don't need to turn off your phone until the plane takes off. And you say, bitch, you don't build planes. Do you remember writing that or just being like saying that and you'd be like, that is it. That's the line.
I remember saying it and being like, that's it. I remember like the experience happened. I was like, I'm going to tell the story that night. That's the great thing when like stand up is up and alive and running. It's like you can run right to the stage. Mm-hmm. And I'm like one of those people. I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to get up and try that tonight while it's like in my brain. You know what I'm saying? So I remember doing it that night. And when I said, bitch, you don't build planes, people like didn't keel over, but they was laughing. And I was like, I love how that sounds. You know, yeah. I was like, that's like exactly how I was feeling.
What's interesting in the film version of the special, you do something which I don't know if I've ever seen, which is you cut to a different camera for each word. So it goes, bitch, cut to another camera, you cut to another camera, don't cut, build, cut, planes. How did y'all decide to do that?
Man, that was just a big baby Reuter. Reuter, who's the editor, he just did it that way. And I was like, that shit look dope. He was just saucing. I am so appreciative of the team, like Chris and Reuter, they were together all the time. And, you know, Chris was very adamant of like, if I come, like, it's kind of like I got to come with Reuter. And we really built a vision together as far as like the direction and how that thing was going to look and feel. And I can't be proud of those guys and like just what happened.
A thing like that underlines something I think that is specific to you, which is there's some comedians who are like really diligent about like maintaining artifice of their stand-up, like the illusion that all of it's spontaneous and they're just like a guy talking and like they're telling a story they've been telling for 10 years, but they talk about how it happened last week. And even in the footage, they try not to like bring attention to the fact that it's a film piece. But I feel like you specifically don't have patience for that bullshit or whatever. Do you feel like that's true? Do you feel like that gets in the way of the truth?
Yeah. And it's like, these motherfuckers ain't dumb.
Yeah.
You ain't tricking nobody but yourself. You know what I'm saying? Like, and if I was tricking somebody, if somebody was really like, oh, she really just thinks of all this today, and like, I wouldn't really want them as a fan.
Yeah.
I don't want that type of fan, to be quite honest. So it's just like, I don't have any interest in that.
In this section is one of my favorite lines in the joke, which is, how we're going to go up in the sky. You're not following the ground rules, baby girl, which is like a sneaky pun because ground rules means two different things. It's one of also the two places in this joke where you laugh at yourself. The others is during the whisper fight where you're imitating the whispering and you call it that goofy, goofy stuff. But, you know, this joke deals with heavy subjects, death, corporate greed. You know, why is it important to you to sort of maintain silly moments, to sort of have these goofy parts?
Bro, you know something really funny? When I thought about the special, I just wanted it to feel whole.
Yeah.
I just wanted it to have everything. Because I was like, I always felt like those were the best people to me. It had everything. And so there was a while when I was building it kind of early on, I thought it was too heavy-handed.
Yeah.
I thought it was way too heavy-handed. I was like, this shit is coming off preachy. And it ain't coming off as funny. And like, people are still laughing, but this shit felt preachy as fuck to me. And I completely just broke mold and I started doing real dumb jokes. I was doing jokes about iPhones. I was doing just jokes about doo-doo.
Yeah.
I had a joke about shitting in public. I was just like, I gotta get goofy because this shit is just feeling too heavy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And what you see in the hour is just a balance of that. It was like I had to find the silly footing like separate and then loop it back into the thing because the shit was just coming off like overbearing for me personally. And I just wanted it to feel whole. I wanted the viewer to just get every time, like on some boxing shit. I wanted them to get every combo. Like I could hit this way, I could go this way, I could go this way, like just on some wanting it to be saucy.
And also, I mean, in so much of your stand-up, you want to convey who you are. You are not constantly like preaching and like making grand statements. You have a silly life as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted all of that to come across. Like, I just really didn't want it to come off as one of these like, I'm gonna tell everybody what it is, dumb motherfuckers. And I wanted it to just feel like a trip through my personal thought process. And like, sometimes it's goofy and sometimes it's critical and sometimes I'm just an asshole. And like, that's like how usually whole people are made, you know? And like, that's just what it is. And I just wanted you to feel that.
How do you feel about laughing on stage? Laughing at your own stuff?
I don't care. If it's funny to me.
All right.
I don't know. Like, I hate all these rules. I really do.
Yeah.
I hate them. I don't believe in them. I believe it's like what works for you is what the fuck works. You know what I'm saying? Now, if you up there and you planning laughs, then yeah, that's mad fucking corny. Don't be up there planning, I'm a laugh right here. That's lame as fuck. But if it actually makes you laugh, then it's just another genuine moment. And that's it.
Yeah. So the joke moves on to the whisper fight. There's a moment where she says, are you on your period? Did you feel like, oh, by having that line here, I could be like subverting how this is used because it is being used between two women? Did you feel like it that way?
Nah, she just really said that to me, bro.
All right. That's fair.
She really asked me if I was on my period. I mean, we ask that of each other sometimes when we someways be in a mood.
Mm-hmm. The other thing about this part of the joke, which is it happens throughout different times of your stand-up, which is you sort of contrast between sort of your masculine presentation and being a woman or being feminine, or even just sort of contrasting being hard and also sort of being soft in broad ways. It's not like a heavy-handed part of the special, but it sort of comes up in little moments. You know, what is sort of fundamentally funny about that contrast, that sort of conflict?
I think it's just all kind of inherently funny because I don't know, because it is actually like my existence.
Yeah.
So it's like a hard question, but not. It's because it is like really who I am. And like, you know, I have two older brothers. They still protect me like a little sister. I didn't take the trash out. They're very like, this is my little sister. You know what I'm saying? And I have a lot of males in my family and I was the youngest. So, you know, my brother still calls me baby girl. And I still have that type of stuff in me where I'm like, no, I'm the baby. I'm cute. And like, that's just how I feel. And that's just an honest part of who I am, as well as my masculine of center self is an honest part of who I am. And those things just live in me.
Mm-hmm. So then the fight builds to, and then you sort of yell, I'm afraid to die. And then you sort of realize that's not what it's about. Can you walk me through sort of that development? And it, because it feels like you were realizing, I mean, obviously it's part of it, but you're sort of, it's interesting to sort of start with a sort of fundamental premise, which is that you're afraid to die. And then at the end of it being like, actually, that is not it. Can you walk me through sort of developing that both sort of off stage and on stage?
I think on stage it was just a real like, and they lived together, right? Because I used to just talk about how I was afraid to die on stage.
Yeah.
Right. And it, and before I had that piece of the joke, that was it. Just like, I'm afraid to die and that's it. You know what I'm saying? And I started not being afraid to die and really thinking about it and being like, you not. Yeah. And so even that discovery kind of came on stage. It was just like, I got to be honest because I feel something different than when I was started telling this joke. Like I've changed in reality and what I thought it was, it really isn't. And when I really sat and thought about it more, I was like, oh, you've always had this weird fear of being a survivor of something. And that's just true.
Yeah. You know, you know, if you're comfortable, can you talk? I guess I'm wondering just sort of how your sort of fear, the fear of death sort of materialized in your life even before you're a comedian, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a sort of active, frequent thought? Like, were you kind of constantly having an intrusive thoughts? Do you remember sort of how it started?
I mean, my mom was ill. You know what I'm saying? I grew up with a sick parent and my mom passed away when I was 16. So death was around me for sure. And I was aware of my mom's mortality by the time I was like 13. I was like very aware that I probably wasn't going to have a mother late in my life and that I was probably going to lose my mother young. You know what I'm saying? And as that became more of a reality, you know, my mom had to keep it real and like talk to me, you know what I'm saying? About that possibility and what that meant for me and like, how was I feeling knowing all this kind of shit was going on? So I think that was the start of that idea living in my head and haunting me a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it also captures what this joke captures, which is partly be afraid of death, but also not feeling invincible like a lot of young people do. Right. There's this people who like, I can fly, whatever. Like, it's possible, I guess I can die. Like, they're aware of it, but like, they don't feel it. Where it's for people that have lost parents or someone early on, I think that's the thing that people don't get, which is sort of like the bliss that you have where you just sort of like go through life. It's not a thing that is so easy to understand.
Yeah. And then I was like, my mom had lupus. And then I got diagnosed with lupus at 20 and I was like fucked up in the hospital for a while with the same kind. So then I'm thinking about my own mortality. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's just like, that's just kind of been hanging. And it's been years of a back and forth with it to come to like a place of peace.
Are you familiar with the term survivor's guilt? The idea that people like, it's interesting because it's a term usually used for people who like survive plane crashes. But, you know, at least in my experience, there's also sort of survivor's guilt of being a person who stays alive if a person close to you dies. Do you feel like that's in this joke as well?
I never thought about it, but maybe. Maybe you just tapped into some.
It's a thing that I heard the joke, and then I'll say it's a realization. So I also lost a parent early on in my life, and it's a thing that it's in this joke. I saw something similar, which is at first you just sort of you feel that like I'm afraid to die, but then you also have that thing of like, you know, you're not necessarily how do you put it, but you do feel a pressure to being the person who's still around.
Yeah. And that's the thing. That's kind of what I'm talking about. It's like, and that's what I'm like, maybe, because that's kind of what I'm talking about. It's just like, when you survive, now you're the survivor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's like a whole nother thing. Like, it's just a whole nother bag of shit. And when I really think about it, I be thinking about that in every way. Like, whenever I thought about the plane crashing, honestly, I'm like, I really realized I never thought about like, oh, you're going to die and then what's going to happen when you're dead? I would just be like, what if you end up just by yourself in the ocean? That would be my thought. Yeah. Like, and then what you going to do? You know what I mean? Like, and that fucking sucks. Like, the idea of that is terrifying to me. Terrifying.
I mean, in general, has your pursuit of comedy been directly tied to your relationship to dying in that
Probably way? Probably 100%. No one's ever asked and I've never openly had to like admit it because I don't really think about it, but I can easily say it's probably 100% tied to my issues with mortality, life and death, that I was kind of like, get off your ass.
Yeah.
Because you only got one of these. You know what I'm saying? I'm very much one of those people like, you only live once. You only have one chance at this shit. It don't rewind and it don't come back. So if you blow it, if you don't try, if you don't shoot, like, that shit's on you.
Yeah. The other thing that I love about this joke, which is you show yourself change, which so many comedians don't do that. They sort of like to present the finished product. They like to present like they know everything. But it feels like throughout the special, it's really important for you to be like, it's okay to not know something. It's okay to be confused. Like, why is it important to you to sort of not be a black and white comedian, like to be a sort of like gray comedian of like, I'm figuring out, this is a realization I'm making for you?
Because I'm a gray person.
Yeah,
I live in the gray. Like, I'm very much, I've kind of always been that, you know, like even when I was a kid, like I remember being in school, I went to Catholic school and the priest came to talk to us and he told us how, like, you know, priests could only be men. And I was like, well, why? And he was like, well, that's just what happened because God had, you know, 12 apostles and they were all men. And that's why priests can only be men. And I was like, well, if someone gets a sex change and now they're a man, could they be a priest? And then I got kicked out. And my brain just always goes there.
Yeah. Yeah, this section has there's not many act outs in this special, but there's a little one here. Ooh. Where you're... How do you feel about act outs? You do a little thing. Yes.
That's interesting. I like that you notice everything. That's just you notice it all. That makes the conversation fun. Yeah. I feel about act outs how I feel about all of it, which is there are no rules. And if it feels right, do it. So yeah. I'm glad they're in there. And when I watch them, I'm like, oh, I feel like all of the act outs in there are like strong and they're all genuine and they don't even feel like act outs. I hate to see act outs as like ways to take up joke space.
Yeah.
I hate that. That drives me insane. And I definitely never wanted to do that. And I also don't like to just see act outs for the sake of act outs. Like I don't believe in this comedy checklist of like, it has to have act outs, it has to have callbacks. I just don't work that way.
Yeah. The other thing is this part of the joke has a Life of Pi reference, which though spot on, feels like a very Sam J reference in that it's not current, but it's also not old. It's just sort of like a reference that is sort of specific to you. There's a few in the special that are like that. How do you sort of approach when you like feel like a pop cultural reference makes sense? Well, what do you like about that reference? It's another way of putting it.
It just fit. It honestly just fit. Like, when I was on stage talking about it, Life of Pi was like, that was another movie that I saw of that burnt into my head of this is trash. Like, yeah. I didn't watch that movie like, whoa. I just was watching it like, what the fuck? That would be so awful. I would be begging for death. Like, this is terrible. And so when I was doing a joke, it just made sense to me. It just worked. You know what I mean? I might reference something. I used to have a joke about the AIDS quilt. If it makes sense to me and I feel like it has relevancy in what I'm saying, I think that's the only relevancy I need.
Yeah.
I don't need like the cultural, like it's relevant right now. It just has to have relevancy to what I'm talking about.
You've talked a little bit about naming your special 3 in the morning as it sort of like captures the vibe and the sort of thoughts you have at 3 in the morning. How would you describe those thoughts and how does the joke fit into that vibe?
It's honestly perfectly that vibe because I feel like it's just like these giant like lucid leaps. I'm just kind of like, and then what if this happens? And what if this happens? And then next thing you know, I was thinking about pizza and now, you know, I'm at like, oh, that's why slaves didn't fight back. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like how the leaps happen in my brain. So, and I feel like that's how it captures that. It just really is like, if I'm up and I'm like smoking a joint and I'm just vibing on some music or thinking, like, that's typically how the thoughts will roll.
Almost the entire special follows one story, kind of. Like, you use the story of going to London with your girlfriend as, like, a thing that sort of moves forward, but you're not only telling that story, you're ultimately sort of, like, using it as jumping off points for other things. Like, you're in London, someone brings up Trump, and that sort of, like, goes you into Trump. How did you sort of land on that structure or even sort of having a structure like that at all?
Man, honestly, I was trying to make it whole. I wanted it to feel like a one journey because that's, to me, what makes a special feel special is some level of that symmetry, some level of that flow to it, that fluidity to it. That, you know, I didn't want it to feel like sections of joke.
Yeah.
You know, like I say this joke, then I say this joke. I just felt like if I'm going to call it a special, it's got to have some level of a through line, right? But I was also like, I want to talk about all this shit. That's really genuinely the shit I want to say right now. And then we went to Europe and I was coming back from Europe and I was still going on the road and I was just talking about the trip. And I started to just find all these things in a trip that I was like, oh, you could just use this to lead you to talking about kids, because I was already talking about kids, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, you could, that part with the Uber, you could slide the Trump thing right in there. Oh, you could just, and I really, that's how it happened.
Yeah.
As I was just kept looking for it because I felt it needed it. But I also wanted it to organically show itself. I didn't want to force it. And I just used the stage time as the time to find it. Like, I really just grinded that bitch out on the stage a lot. Just was up there awkward, sometimes just talking about one thing for 35 minutes and pissing audiences off. You know what I mean? Like, just really just took it to the mattress in that way and was just kind of like, we gonna get it there.
You know, you mentioned where, and even in interviews you'll talk about, that first special really was important to you. Like, in a way, for years, you've been talking about how you want your first special to be something. Or you'll reference how Chris Rock's Bring the Pain was just sort of like this moment where he had this first special and he sort of introduced himself. What do you think it is about specifically first specials that have such potential in a way that maybe even like a later special might not?
Because no one knows your voice yet. So it's exciting to meet you.
Mm-hmm.
They ain't met you before, you know? Once they know your voice, they met you. So now they think they know what you think.
Yeah.
But when they first meet you, they're like, I don't know what the fuck this motherfucker's about to say. And that's exciting.
Yeah. There's and maybe not, but there's a bit on the special about, you know, Obama might have been the first black president, but Trump is the first N-word president. And that feels like, I don't know if intentionally or not, but it sort of feels in conversation with sort of the famous Chris Rock bit from Bring the Pain, the black people versus N-words joke. You know, either was an intentional, or now thinking about it, do you feel like it feels like a contemporary extension of what you responded to so much about that original joke?
Chris Rock is just someone who's influenced me. Mm-hmm. You know, even before I knew I wanted to be a stand-up, I would watch Chris Rock and just be like, he was one of the first stand-ups that I could identify, like, oh, you could be black and do it that way. That's interesting.
What way?
Because I feel like we weren't getting the scope of our artists. So it was like, you either just had Def Jam shit or nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I wasn't funny like that. You know what I mean? I'm way more just like, I'm just not funny in that style. I don't even know how to put it. But then when I saw Chris, it was like, oh, this is like hitting on all the notes that make sense to me. But it's still very black and very like, in that space, like it can live in the Def Jam space 100%. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was super interesting to me. And so like certain bits just stuck with me for my whole life. Like Niggas versus Black People is probably my number one favorite bit in the fucking world for what it was so funny, but also just what it did. It put a stamp in culture immediately. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
Now things are different. You know what I mean? Now think different. Which is what I love about stand-up. And so probably just because I'm influenced in that way, it probably is an extension of that in some way.
So watching your special and sort of watching your comedy, the thing that it's sort of always that stuck out to me is that you're a realist. Does that make sense? That you're like a staunch realist, while there's like some comedians who are like try to talk about how the world should be, or they talk about the ideals. I feel like your comedy comes from here how it is, and we got to deal with it in a sort of realistic terms.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you? Do you know why is it important to you to be grounded in that way? And where do you think it comes from?
I mean, I think it just comes from like, that's how I grew up. That's the type of parent I had, you know? That's how I was taught to deal with tragedy. That's how I was taught to deal with things. You know, my brother went to jail when I was young, and it was like, this is some sad shit, but it doesn't get to determine your life. It just is. And like, we got to move forward. And I think a lot of kids who come from impoverished situations or, you know, poor neighborhoods are taught to deal in that, because you don't really have room for like the other shit. If you live in the other space, you'll be held up in life. You know what I'm saying? So it's like you kind of have to be like, what is in front of me?
Hmm.
And what can I do with what's in front of me to get me somewhere else. And like, that's all you have. So in a lot of ways, that's just how my brain works again. It's just like, that's how I truly see the shit.
You know, as we talked about at the beginning, you quit after first trying stand-up at 21 because it didn't feel right. And it was hard to put your finger on, but it was just sort of off. You know, now that you're experiencing it and you filmed this special, can you now say like, oh, this is exactly what it should feel like? You know, what is that feeling that you now are at?
Yeah, 100%. I didn't have anything to say. I didn't even know. I was still sucking dicks, bro. I didn't even know who I was, man. You know what I'm saying? So it was like, how can you go up and present anything? You know? I had no idea who I was. So I think that was the 90% of it not feeling right. It was just like, I didn't feel right.
Yeah.
So I couldn't translate anything. And so the connection I was looking for, that like tingly, like it can only come from God type thing, it wasn't happening. And I was like, but I love this and I think I could be great at this. So like, why? It's not supposed to feel like this. You know what I'm saying? I don't know why my brain was doing that, but that's what my brain was doing. And when I got back on stage at 28, about to be 29, it was like, yeah, it's time. It just felt like it's time.
So that sound means it's time for our final segment. It's the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's a laughing round. Shorter questions, way chiller, I promise. And you can pass if you don't have an answer to any of these. Do you have a favorite joke, like a street joke?
It's one my brother used to tell me as a kid, actually. And it's just a bad joke. How did the gum cross the road?
How?
It was stuck to the chicken's foot.
All right. The dumber these are, it's always my favorite. Is there a joke of another comedian's that you wish you could steal, but in a way where it's not like you'd get in trouble? It's like a different dimension where everything's exactly the same, but you have this joke. It's a joke you saw and you're like, oh, I wish I had that, or I wish I thought of that.
I can't think of it right now, but probably at least 4 jokes that Jack Knight has written and done that I've been like, shit, I wish I would have thought of that.
I have 2 SNL questions, and here's the first. You've talked about how the best of Eddie Murphy, I guess VHS, was really seminal and it was a thing you watched a lot. Do you have any specific memory from his episode that you could talk about?
The craziest part is just when he first like got there and like, you know, we're pitching and he was just being so cool. You know, he was just talking about how his office used to be set up and like just getting a sit in a room with Eddie Murphy and just talk. And talk about a job that, you know, to some degree we've shared and an experience that we've both had, and like hear his perspective and him asking like how it is now and finding similarities and differences in that was just so wild. It was just so crazy.
Velvet Jones was in Black Jeopardy, right? And you helped write that. What was it like writing a character that you sort of, like, it's almost like these characters are their own famous people that you got to meet.
It was really, like, wow, because in pitch, I did a Velvet Jones pitch. And then the next day, they were like, hey, these people kind of like that. They were kind of into that. Maybe we could write something up, you know, and do it in this space. And I was like, oh, that's mad cool, because, like, they originated this shit, you know? Like, he brought his original writers and stuff. So I'm like, these are the people that came up with this shit, and I'm just, a fan, honestly. And so to be able to even touch that character and then have Eddie do it and, like, have the people that he came up with this with be like, no, that was on target and funny, and it was just, like, it was an honor, really.
Yeah. To talk about another sketch, I think one of my favorites, if not my favorite sketch that I believe you helped write, was the Cha-Cha Slide sketch with John Mulaney.
Yes. I love when people do this, though, and they say a sketch I didn't. I've had that happen to me like 3 times.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, no, I didn't do that. And they're like, eh.
What are the sketches they think you did?
Just anything black.
That's what I assumed.
I'm like, that helped me.
But so Cha-Cha Slide, I tell me everything about that sketch, because I feel like it was a thing that existed. I thought it was really unique, and I thought it was a really interesting tone for a sketch. Can you talk about the pitch of it, the writing of it, anything about that sketch?
You know, Tuck just kind of like, Tuck had the thing where he was like, he want to do something to the Cha-Cha Slide. That's usually how some shit start at SNL, you know? It's just like, someone will have an idea, like, yo, I want to do something where John does this. He like, And, you know, we'll kind of like fish it around a different writer, see who bites type of thing, you know? So he was just kind of like, yo, you think you could, you know, fuck with that? I was like, yeah, let's, you know, jam on it. And then, you know, later on that Tuesday, we just started like jamming on it. And, you know, it starts with just building the space. Like, where is this all going to take place? Oh, it could be like this. It's really that organic. I think people think like SNL's some crazy like space where like Lauren's whipping us and then like, and we like running on a treadmill and writing at the same time or some shit. But really, it's that organic. It's just like, oh, it could be a wedding. Oh, yeah, Ego would be perfect. Oh, yeah, then we could do this. Oh, yeah, we could do that. And that's just how it gets built. You know what I mean?
Is there a moment in that sketch that you particularly like?
I love the Tom Joyner Cruise line. It's my favorite because I got it up in there and it's the blackest shit. It's such an inside black thing.
Yeah.
That it makes everybody, and I love the alpha phi alpha shit. That's another one where like homies hit me up like, that's so fucking fire. You know, it's like those just like super black moments that it's like, I'm sure white people will watch it like, what?
Yeah, as a white person who watched it, I was like, I know this. You could tell when something's a specific, even if you don't get it. Like, you like, can tell when something rings as, like, a funny specific thing, even though if you don't have the, like, immediate touch tones.
Yeah.
So the next two guests on the podcast are Cecily Strong and John Mulaney.
Hey!
I want to know if you have any questions for either of them.
Please ask Cecily for me, how's her summer, and how did she get her skin to be so glowing and luxurious?
Mm-hmm.
And you can ask John, when's the last time he wore my girlfriend's Martin hat that she gave him?
Aww.
Great. I love that. Maybe we'll end with this one, which is, do you have a joke that you really thought was funny that you kept on trying but just kept on not working? And maybe you gave it up, maybe you still haven't, but you'll sort of like never give up your personal belief that it's funny. You just sort of like haven't figured out a way to get the audience on board yet.
Yeah, I got a joke about the AIDS quilt that I think is hilarious. But it's also one of my, like, I just be doing dark shit. It's one of these dark little jokes that, like, every time I do it, they, like, no. Especially yeah. Just that, like, I was watching this documentary on the AIDS quilt, and it was showing, like, old footage. Because they were talking about, like, where it is now, and, like, does it still matter to people? Like, the people that were initially, like, there and, you know, sew the name into the quilt, all that kind of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And they were showing the guy who had like curated the quilt, and they were showing like old footage of this dude. And he was just so excited about this, you know? And I was like, this is a very dark thing to be like ambitious about. And yeah. he was like, one day this quilt will fill this whole field. And I was just like, that is sick. Like, where people's ambitions lie is really wild. And then I was like, he's probably really sad that Magic Johnson didn't die from full-blown AIDS, because that probably was going to be the centerpiece of the quilt. But people don't go for
it. Yeah, there's a lot of landmines of that one. People like, I don't know.
But I'm a get that motherfucker. It might end up in a movie or something. You know, it might have to live somewhere else for people to laugh at it. But yeah. Shit's funny.
It's like you need it to be a character says it, and then someone be like, you're fucked up.
Yeah, like it might need that space. You know what I'm saying? But it's funny to me. And that's been the dope thing about sketch, is some of them type of ideas, I found a way to make them live in sketches, and that's so exciting. Because I'm like, oh, this works better here than me just like saying some nut shit.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can find 3 in the Morning on Netflix. Follow Sam on social media at SamJComic. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Art Chung, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing round suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with Cecily freaking Strong. Have a good one.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright.
exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W, and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.